Well, thanks, you guys, for coming, and thanks to Sabria for that great presentation. My name is Hannah Cooper, and I'm going to be talking with you guys today about public housing relocations in Atlanta and Relocators Health. And before I start, I want to recognize my wonderful colleagues and co-authors on this project, and also recognize in particular two people who were in the room, Dr. Sabria Linton, who's fortunately going to eat now after presenting, and Ms. Jocelyn Hunter-Jones, and then some of the other fantastic colleagues on this project. So we are living through a paradigm shift right now in how U.S. public housing policies actually work, what their goal is. Back in the 1950s and 1960s, the Department of Housing and Urban Development and local public housing authorities explicitly sought to concentrate public housing units into campuses and superblocks. Beginning in the 1980s, though, there was growing concern about these superblocks and campuses, and this concern came from a variety of different quarters. Some people were concerned about the impact of concentrated poverty on public housing residents themselves or on the health of their neighbors. Others worried that these complexes impeded urban gentrification. And then additionally, some complexes began to fall into disrepair in the absence of federal funding for maintenance. In response to these concerns, the U.S. Congress convened the National Commission on Severely Distressed Public Housing in the early 1990s. And this commission came out with a statement that severely distressed public housing must be repaired or demolished. And just to give you a little bit of a definition for severely distressed public housing, it's public housing complexes that have unusually high rates of poverty, unemployment, or violent crime. There were several public housing policies that were developed in response to this congressional report, and they tended to seek to demolish, rehabilitate, or replace severely distressed public housing complexes, and then move the original residents of these public housing complexes to voucher-subsidized rental units in the private market. So this would be Section 8 or housing choice. These policies also sought to revitalize the sites where distressed public housing projects were located and improve the neighborhood, to decrease the concentration of very low-income families, and to improve the economic conditions of relocating residents. And some examples of these policies that you might know of might be Moving to Opportunity and Hope 6. The Urban Institute, if you're interested in learning more about the relocations, the Urban Institute is a great source. They've done some remarkable work on relocations in the U.S. What they found in one multi-site study of five different cities is that relocations tend to move people to voucher-subsidized housing in neighborhoods that are less poor and less violent than the areas that surrounded their original public housing complexes. But I want to note that still, if you look at the Urban Institute multi-site sample, still, post-relocation, a lot of people were living in areas with pretty high poverty rates. So people experienced improvements, but maybe not of the magnitude that we might hope. At issue in this study is how post-relocation changes in neighborhood conditions relate to several different health outcomes among relocators. There's a large and growing body of literature that suggests that economic disadvantage and social disorder, which are two of the things that seem to change post-relocation, are related to several different health outcomes, including vulnerability to HIV, substance misuse, and depression. And so what we designed the study to do is to learn whether post-relocation changes in neighborhood economic conditions, social disorder, and also in sex ratios might be associated with substance misuse, depression, and vulnerability to HIV and other sexually transmitted infections, or STIs, over time in a cohort of adult relocators. And by design, the majority of our cohort members were misusing substances at baseline. The study was located in Atlanta, Georgia. Atlanta is at the forefront of demolishing distressed public housing complexes, for better or for worse. About 50,000 Atlanta residents have been relocated from distressed public housing complexes to voucher-subsidized housing since 1995. So that's really a mass internal displacement of people. Can you guys imagine why Atlanta was at the forefront of this in the early 1990s? The 1996 Olympics, right? So if you guys were watching that, a lot of the Olympic stadiums and fields were actually built on the footprints of public housing complexes. Now, this study was focusing on the final wave of relocations. In that wave, about seven public housing complexes were targeted between 2008 and 2009. The relocators were given housing choice vouchers to find new housing and rental units in the private market. This was a longitudinal multi-level study of 172 residents living in seven public housing complexes in Atlanta. We've gathered seven waves of data. I'll be presenting findings today from waves one through four. Wave one was gathered pre-relocation in about 2008, 2009, depending on the complex. Wave two was post-relocation, and waves three and four were gathered every 9 months thereafter. To take part in the study, you had to be residing in one of the seven complexes in Atlanta that were emptied and demolished about 2008, 2009. You had to be an African-American adult who was sexually active in the past 12 months. Almost all people in Atlanta and also in the U.S. overall who live in severely distressed public housing are African-American, and we can talk about some of the reasons why that might be afterwards during the question and answer session. We oversampled people who engaged in harmful alcohol or other drug abuse at baseline. We used non-probability quota methods to actually create the sample, and we tried to reach as diverse a group of residents as we possibly could. We administered surveys at each wave of data collection to measure each outcome and several individual level covariates. The outcomes of interest here were drug and alcohol dependence, the use of illegal drugs, binge drinking, depression, a couple of sexual risk outcomes, including perceived partner risk and indirect concurrency. Indirect concurrency means that you believe that your partner has other partners. Our perceived partner risk index consisted of participant perceptions about partner drug use, incarceration history, and STI status, and higher values indicate greater risk. We tested participants' urine with their consent for three different STIs. Those STIs were chlamydia, gonorrhea, or trichomonas. And we created a dichotomous outcome that just indicated whether or not someone was infected with one of those three STIs. At each wave, we gathered information on participant home addresses. We geocoded those addresses to census tracts. And then we used existing administrative databases to describe several characteristics of these tracts at each wave, including tract-level violent crime rates, the density of businesses that were licensed to sell alcohol for off-premises consumption, the tract poverty rate, median household income, high school graduation rate, and sex ratios. Not surprisingly, the census tract measures were often highly correlated with one another, so we used a principal components analysis, and that analysis revealed two components. One was social disorder, and the other was economic disadvantage, and then we also had sex ratios as a separate exposure. We engaged in intensive retention strategies, and so we had a high retention rate by wave four. This is quite, I have to say that I really credit my team to this, and in particular Jocelyn Hunter-Jones, because during this time, the entire cohort moved at least once. Several people moved multiple times, and of course most people misused substances at baseline. To analyze our data, we used multi-level models, and we controlled for important individual level covariates. So turning to the description of the sample. So in the sample, slightly more than half of the participants were women, and not surprisingly, most were very poor. Notably, as has been found in other cohorts of public housing relocators, people's income did not really increase markedly post-relocation, and that's been found in many different studies with relocators. By design, there were high rates of substance misuse at baseline. We want to note that we see sustained declines in substance misuse over time. We also see high depression scores in the sample at baseline, which also drop as time passes. The mean perceived partner risk score was about 2 at baseline, and about a third of the sample reported that their partner had another partner at baseline. Both of these measures declined post-relocation, as do the percent of the sample who tested positive for an STI. So table 5 presents the characteristics of the census tracts where people lived at each wave. So at wave 1, when participants were living in their public housing complexes, we see that the tracts were deeply impoverished and had high rates of violent crime and had sex ratios that were well below 1. Post-relocation, we see improvements in most of these indicators. So I want to note, though, that as was found in the Urban Institute study, we still see high rates of, say, exposure to poverty post-relocation. It's just better than it was pre-relocation. The sex ratios also remained below 1. We could still analyze this as an exposure. We had quite a lot of variation around that mean within the sample. So how were these changes in census tract characteristics related to our outcomes over time? Let's start with substance misuse. So multi-level models that controlled for key individual level confounders indicate that a one standard deviation improvement in economic conditions was associated with a decrease from 34% to 20% in binge drinking and with a decline from 37% to 16% in illicit drug use. And just to orient you, on average, a one standard deviation improvement in economic conditions translated into a decline in the poverty rate of 17 percentage points, a decline of 21 percentage points in the percent of adults with a high school degree or less, and with an increase in median income of about $20,000. A reduction in tract level alcohol outlet density of at least 3 alcohol outlets per square mile predicted a reduction in binge drinking from 32% to 18%. So overall, we see a protective relationship between improved economic conditions, reduced spatial access to alcohol, and substance misuse, at least as we measured it. Turning to depression, we find that a one standard deviation improvement in tract level economic conditions was associated with a slight decline in depression scores. And now moving into HIV-related vulnerability, we find that a one standard deviation improvement in economic conditions was associated with a decline in perceived partner risk scores. Participants who experienced declines in community violence had a reduction in indirect concurrency of 14 percentage points. And finally, improved sex ratios that were closer to 1:1 over time, were associated with reduced odds of testing positive for an STI. Let's talk about the limitations of this study first. This was a non-probability-based sample. I want to note, though, that we have HUD data on the demographic characteristics or select demographic characteristics of each of the complexes where we recruited from. And we find, actually, that the sample demographic characteristics were quite similar to the characteristics of the underlying population in each complex. We had no comparison group. We'd love to have a comparison group. Some public housing complexes remain in Atlanta, but they're not severely distressed. So the residents are quite different, and the communities in which they're located are quite different. And so those complexes cannot really serve as a true control group or comparison group. Finally, we couldn't randomize relocators to communities. The housing authority didn't call us and ask our permission and ask us to randomize people to different neighborhoods post-relocation. But I want to note that there were no statistically significant differences in post-relocation improvements in neighborhood quality by baseline substance misuse, depression, or sexual risk. So just to wrap this up, in this sample, we found post-relocation improvements in all the health outcomes and health behavior studied. In the main, post-relocation improvements were greater among individuals who moved to census tracts with less economic disadvantage and social disorder and with more equitable sex ratios. Future research is going to be dedicated to trying to understand the mechanisms behind the associations I've just described. And in particular, we're focusing on the role of network composition and structure in mediating these relationships. And so stay tuned for that, because Dr. Linton is going to be taking the lead on those papers. I want to acknowledge our study participants, our funders, and the Atlanta Housing Authority.